Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So in today's episode, we're going to be diving into the closure of Rec Room. So Rec Room started in 2016, and then they're going to be closing down on June 1st, 2026. So a good 10-year run there. And, you know, they were kind of riding high on a lot of the metaverse hype. They raised a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars. And then they were launching on all these different platforms, like over a dozen different platforms from iOS and Android and PlayStation and Xbox, but also PC VR and also the standalone headsets. So I had a chance to talk to Sean Whiting, who was kind of in the inside for a long time. He played a number of different roles at Rec Room, including the head of creators, the head of user acquisition, the head of community growth and support in teams, and also community design. So over the years, he was amongst all these different roles. And yeah, just getting some reflections on him as to like what happened at Rec Room and some of his kind of inside take from his own perspective of interacting with the community. And also just sharing some of our memories of Rec Room and things that we loved about the platform. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Sean happened on Thursday, May 21st, 2026. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
I'm Sean Whiting. I've been doing VR stuff since maybe like 2013. And a lot of what I've done has been focused on social VR, I would say. Hanging out with other people in VR and virtual worlds in particular is kind of the short way to say it.
Nice. Maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
Yeah, I started as a film major. So I went to film school. I had a minor in religion and philosophy, which was kind of fun. I tried to combine those two. And I graduated. I did some film work. I lived in LA for a little bit. I didn't really like LA. I moved back home to Virginia where I grew up and started my own video production company and did a bunch of kind of like video and mixed media projects. Through doing that and running my own business, I was like, man, I should really learn more about, you know, how to run a small business and all this financial stuff that I'm kind of just winging it. And then I took some graduate classes in entrepreneurship at Virginia Tech. And through doing that, I met my co-founder for my first kind of like VR startup, Converge, that was Hayden Lee and I. Hayden had a DK1 and he gave me my first VR demo. One of the first things I was telling people recently that I played that really struck me was Dread Halls was like an amazing experience to me. It kind of blew my mind. For people that aren't early VR people, Dread Halls was like a kind of like horror type experience where you're going through these like catacombs and it's very dark in the world and you've got a torch and you're kind of navigating and you're hearing kind of like monsters and these kind of like horrifying sounds all around you. So it was very, I don't know, visceral and immersive to me. And it was kind of struck me as like a very good sign for the future of the VR as kind of like a experience or like film type medium. It's like, oh man, you could do so much stuff in here. And then pretty quickly discovered after I ordered my own DK1 that like network stuff was very compelling to both Hayden and I. Just like being in, I think the first demo we ever did was just like literally hooking up the headset because you have no, you know, there's no hands at the time. So it's like a headset and then a mouse and keyboard. Yeah, we just had like gray boxes hooked up to our heads and we would talk and just noticing the sound and the head shift and everything. It was just very exciting to us. So that kind of started us down a path of exploring all these social VR things, which became Converge, which was just like a very basic early social VR thing that we worked on.
Mm. Yeah, I remember having a meeting with Ben Lang in Converge where I was talking around, like he wanted to meet up and he ended up like airing some Voices of VR podcasts on Road to VR back in the day. But we had that first meeting. I think you might've even been there with us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I remember those days. And actually there's a kind of an aesthetic similarity to that low poly head-based kind of social VR and kind of the low poly aesthetic of Rec Room. At what point did you first come across Rec Room?
It would have been later after we left Converge. So like we we went through Y Combinator with Converge, the Y Combinator fellowship program, and they gave us some money, and that was nice. And we were approaching like CV1 launch, consumer launch of the headset. Most of the company's life was just purely in the DK1, DK2 phase, which was kind of fun. But as we got closer to launch, we were like, oh man, we're either going to have to raise a bunch of money and hire up a big team here, or we can take what we've built and the opportunities it's affording us and go do something different. So Hayden went to Big Screen and I went to Pluto VR, which was focusing on a kind of like pure communications infrastructure, like Skype of VR type thing, very focused on avatars and that social presence with each other. And I was at Pluto for maybe about a year, year and a half. And then while I was there, I had a meeting with one of the Rec Room co-founders, Cameron Brown, because they were leaving. He and all the other Rec Room co-founders were leaving Microsoft and they were considering working on a VR project in social VR. And he had seen that I had done Converge. And we had like a lunch and a chat about social VR and if he thought there was something interesting to build there. And I was like, yeah, I think you could build something really interesting there. He had some like rough ideas and we kind of like chatted about it. And then I think we roughly stayed in touch. And then once I left Pluto, I was either going to start my own company, probably still in the VR space, or, I was very roughly considering joining another team if I was like super sold on it. And I had a meeting with Nick, the Rec Room CEO, and he just impressed me with the vision and what they had built so far. And I, shortly after Rec Room started, I ended up joining like the early team.
Yeah, and I remember we last had a talk around Rec Room. I did an interview with you in January of 2020. It was like at this event that was happening in Seattle. It's like Kaleidoscope, and then you happened to be there, and then the pandemic happened there shortly after that. And then I think I did an interview with Cameron like a year later. I think that was probably at the point where like Rec Room was, had a unicorn status of being a valuation of over $1 billion. It seemed to be opening up in all these other platforms. And then on March 30th, 2026, it was announcing that on June 1st of 2026 that Rec Room would be shutting down. So what's the story with what happened, and how do you start to make sense of the journey of Rec Room, and how do you start to tell that story?
I was just talking through this with someone else recently too, because I think a lot of people, rightfully so, like you're saying, they see Rec Room was kind of on top of the world, especially in the VR scene for quite a while, especially around the like 2020 to 2022 timeframe where everyone started going crazy because, the pandemic hits and everyone can't leave their home, especially for us with a younger user base. Everyone in middle school, high school, college is basically at home now, and our numbers took a huge spike upwards. So, and then, just to set the scene around that time, Facebook changes its name to Meta and is all in on the metaverse, and they're launching a product very similar to Rec Room, and Roblox IPOs for $100 billion, and the metaverse is the only thing anyone wants to talk about. That's the future. Now's the time because of the pandemic. Rec Room's numbers are going crazy, and that's around the time we raise a lot of money, obviously, right? Like you can demand a much higher valuation if all those things are happening. So when everyone talks about like, Rec Room was worth whatever, these $3.5 billion, and everything like seemed like it was going so well, it's like you've got to remember that's at the peak of metaverse hype and the peak of like virtual world hype and like mid-pandemic essentially. So just to set the stage, that's like the top of the hill for Rec Room hype wise. And then I think what people are, when they're asking like, what happened, you're just asking kind of like, what does it look like on the downward slope of that peak for us? And I think it looks like everyone who was in school goes back to school. So like the amount of players you've got in the game just constantly is going to go down. It's going to get more spiky, like the weekends start peaking more. And like, obviously, I think a lot of the metaverse hype starts to wear off. We do at that point have a good amount of money in the bank, although we've hired up to like, 250, 300 people. So the Rec Room team is much larger pre-pandemic. leaving the office for the pandemic, we had like 40 or 45 people on the team. And then like a year or two later, it's close to 300, which was, that's a lot of hiring and a lot of growth there and a lot of expenses. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's like a shocking story. There's no kind of major like, oh, that behind the scenes, this crazy thing happened and explains it all. It's just kind of a typical story where, I think the company rode a hype cycle and then we exited the hype cycle and usage was like flat to down off of pandemic crazy highs, and you're struggling to recapture those user numbers now that you've monetized, because we put Rec Tokens and Rec Room Plus in the game and like 2019, I think. Now there's a huge push to like drive revenue. And I think we just struggled to maintain the growth rates that, you were seeing during the pandemic. And probably the spending was a lot higher as well during the pandemic. Like the amount people were spending in virtual worlds and in Rec Room, I believe, was much higher if I went back and looked at those charts, which makes sense, right? You're not doing anything else. You're not going out. You're not going to movie theaters. You're not buying food. You're not going on vacations. So you can spend a lot more money on avatar items and whatever these digital experiences are that you're having. So yeah, I think like 2023 onward, maybe growth isn't quite as good as we would have thought. And then like 2023 to 2024, you're like struggling, trying different things, seeing what we can get to work. And then I think 2025 is when you see the first round of layoffs. And I think that's the signal to like the outside world and everyone, and like the real signal internally too, where it's like, okay, something big is changing here. And then, you can see a lot of what Rec Room tried to do, what we tried to do with the kind of like AI experiments. It's like, how can we use AI to make the creation tools easier for people to onboard into, if we can have more creators making more things that are higher quality because the AI tools are so good. So yeah, I think people who were following Rec Room probably saw those AI experiments, and I think people could see that we were looking for something that would help with like creator productivity there. And we did a lot of monetization experiments around stuff like Roomie, who was a robot that you would spawn into your dorm room and you could interact with him, which was wildly popular. Like the usage on Roomie was pretty insane. The problem is, once you start to, and I think it was because we made Roomie a Rec Room Plus feature. So like if you had Rec Room Plus, you could interact with Roomie. The problem was people were interacting with Roomie so much that I think the usage was blowing past what made even Rec Room Plus sustainable, right? So you're paying us $8 a month for Rec Room Plus. You're using $20 worth of Roomie because you're talking to him for 5 hours a day or whatever. Like, that's not sustainable. So now we have to sell Roomie batteries that you buy to power Roomie after the free amount of chatting with him dies. And then like at that point, usage drops off pretty quickly because, he's fun to talk to, but maybe he's not $10 fun to talk to, sort of thing. So now we're getting into the era of like us trying stuff, like what can work here, what can really, increase revenue. Yeah, I mean, I'll pause there, but this is like a kind of a timeline in my head of how things were going.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful just because I think that's sort of the last like on the record conversations I've had with Rec Room employees was in that peak of the hype cycle. So I wasn't sort of tracking things as it was progressing through the rest of that story. But one thing that I just wanted to kind of ask and unpack a little bit more was this tension of a user-generated platform, but also you're creating your own first-party experiences. And I'm curious if you found that the first party experiences, in terms of the distribution of all the attention and what people were playing, if you saw that it was a bit of a power law dynamic where like 80% of the usage came from the 20% of the stuff that was coming from the first party app, or if you really saw like a really robust user-generated ecosystem within Rec Room.
Oh yeah, it became very robust. It was like a slog to get there though. Like in the early days, like when we first introduced custom rooms is what we called it, like the ability to drop stuff in a room and then save it And then eventually we added Circus, which was let you add logic into it so you could have more fully featured games. I think it took like 2 or 3 years for any of those games to be anywhere close to competing with like what we could do with Rec Room Originals in Unity. And we were very aware of that. I think we were, monitoring what retention looked like for the rooms and like average time spent per room for the Rec Room, originals is what we called them, RROs, the stuff we were making versus what the community was making. So, yeah, in the early days, it was rough. And a lot of the usage was still probably like 80%, like first party Rec Room stuff and 20% UGC. But as time went on, like probably, I don't know if I could pinpoint a year, but at some point I remember internally we had a big kind of like hurrah that a majority of time spent, like 50.5% was of all player time spent was in custom rooms or UGC. And that was kind of like a very interesting point for us. And then it starts to go to 60%, 70%. And it definitely climbed up. I forget what the maximum percent it reached, but it was clearly trending in the direction of, the players are making stuff more compelling to the other players than we can make anymore. Like we would launch some Rec Room original stuff and it would like not do anywhere near as well as like the top 10 player created rooms just because the players got so good at notice. Like, it's a lot of stuff for younger people too, right? So it's like we're all probably like at least late 20s plus making a lot of these Rec Room originals. And then you see someone make something called Meme Elevator, where it's just an elevator that goes through different floors and you jump out and then like a meme happens at you and then you go up another floor. And like that's the most popular room for like months at a time, It's like we would have never designed Meme Elevator, but it's like one of the most wildly popular rooms. So yeah, it flipped at a certain point on like player time spent. And then I remember we did a whole user interface redesign at that point because we were like, there was a little bit of still prioritizing the Rec Room originals in the UI where it's like, well, we know these things are high quality and we want you to see a high quality room in the beginning. So we like pinned them all at the top essentially of the play menu. And then eventually we were like, there are player created rooms that are outperforming in almost every way the Rec Room originals. So we should start pinning those at the top. And that was like a big moment for the community when they saw us start to mix in Rec Room originals with the player created rooms. They were like, wow, Rec Room's changed. It's not these first party games. And there's also, the custom rooms. It's like, it's all just UGC now. And Rec Room is just one publisher of some of the games. So that was like a big context change for a lot of the community that they had to get used to.
Now, and my recollection was that the last time we chatted in 2020, that there was a sense that Rec Room was profitable. I don't know if Rec Room ever really was profitable in terms of the amount of expenses that were going out versus the revenue that was coming in. Would Rec Room ever reach that state of profitability? And was it a matter of like the usage numbers went down and so that it was profitable at one point, but then that went away with all the different trends of people moving away? Or was it always a challenge to try to have enough monetization on a social VR platform?
Yeah, I mean, monetization was always a struggle. Although, I mean, if we go back and look at like literally our expenses and the server infrastructure and all that versus the money that was coming in, I think there probably were points where we were profitable. I don't remember explicitly looking at all those things in detail, but like, I think it's all just a matter of how you're spending money. Like if we had turned off any amount of, spending at a certain point, like we're doing zero user acquisition spending, we're not spending any money on like any of that stuff that is just like growth related, right? Because if you minus all that stuff out of the equation, like it's much easier to get to profitability. So I think we were probably there at various points. But at the same time, like you need to grow the user base, so you need to be spending some amount on User acquisition, or I did a bunch of spending on like we had a video partner program and an influencer program at a certain point. So yeah, it's I mean I don't even remember if at any point we ever said publicly like whether like Rec Room was profitable or not, because I guess kind of like I'm saying it, one month you could have been profitable and another month you couldn't have been because you implement some new service and it's way more costly than you thought. And then over the next 2 months, you start cutting expenses from that whatever voice chat service you adopted that was too expensive. And now you're profitable again, but now you had a huge usage spike. So now you're not profitable again. So like, I'm sure we dipped into profitability at some point in there. But yeah, if you start spending, serious money on user acquisition because we just launched on iOS and we're running a bunch of ads on the Apple App Store or whatever, it's like now you've lost it because you're just spending all that money on UA and marketing and these sorts of things to try to grow usage.
Yeah, I wanted to ask around this kind of hybrid approach because Rec Room was always a VR first game, but then at some point started launching on like PlayStation, Xbox, you have iOS and Android and Switch. You have all these platforms that you're on. And so I'm just curious from like in retrospect, if you feel like that it creates like a bit of a hierarchy in terms of people having a little bit more capabilities for some of the games. The balancing between those two, I think, can be a little bit skewed if you're on a screen based and just using a controller versus if someone's in VR, they may just have way more situational awareness and ability to do well. So I'm just curious to hear like if you have any take on whether or not that strategy of really bringing in that 2D experience within Rec Room, if that had any sort of long-term effects in terms of just creating more of an unequal experience, or if there was experiences that were preferenced over one or the other.
I mean, from the like player feedback and community dynamics angle, it was super interesting to move from VR only into 2D screens because you got to watch the VR players have this sort of like elitist attitude. When the 2D players show up, they start calling them like pancake players or, flat screen player. They have like these like just like derogatory terms for people that don't have a VR headset, essentially, which was interesting to watch. And the thing that would happen is they would slowly adopt like whichever platform got added. The initial reaction is, this is bad. Rec Room's changing. It shouldn't have done this. And then over months or like the first year, eventually they make enough friends on that platform that they're like, it's actually fine. And then we add a new platform and they're like, that new platform is terrible. Those people shouldn't be added. This is a disaster. And then they make enough friends on Xbox that they're like, Xbox is cool, actually. And then you add iOS and they're like, this is really a disaster to add the mobile players. What a nightmare. And then they make enough friends on iOS and they use it themselves when they're traveling or whatever. And they're like, okay, this is fine, I guess. And then you add Switch and they're like, this is truly a disaster. And then they make enough friends on Switch and it goes away. It doesn't become an issue anymore. So like that was a constant dynamic. But for like the in-game affordances on like each of these things, I do think just because Rec Room started as a VR app, like our top creators for the longest time were all VR. Like they were people who had a VR headset because the using the Maker Pen, like the Maker Pen was designed in the early days entirely for VR users. So like interacting with the Maker Pen as an interface and the ability to, pop out circuits and complex objects and craft these things was just easier for VR. And then we had to adapt the Maker Pen into like 2D, and especially it was a struggle on mobile to get all the Maker Pen UI and kind of creation flows working for, a small device in your hand. It was just not designed initially for that. So it was a huge overhaul to get it there. So in a lot of ways, the VR players had advantages just due to Rec Room having started as a VR app. And I think that persisted almost until the very end, just because it was such a huge amount of work to get all those different creation tools and everything working across all the different platforms. Like, whenever you change something in the Maker Pen, you're like, how does that feel on mouse and keyboard? How does that feel in a VR headset with six DOF controllers? How does that feel on a PlayStation 5 controller? How does it feel on an Xbox controller? How does it feel on the Switch? How does it feel on an iPad? How does it feel on an Android phone with your two thumbs? Like, to get all of those feeling good is like near impossible. So I would say a lot of the time, the VR experience, especially for creation and for a lot of things, like the early quests, going through the golden trophy with the bow and arrow and like literally pulling back the bow and hitting something with it is way more compelling and just like visceral and juicy feeling than it is to be like hitting the pull back the bow button on a mobile device. So I think in a lot of ways, the VR players had the more compelling experience and had the better UI and all that stuff just because it was originally started there.
Yeah, I remember during the pandemic, I was playing quite a lot of Rec Room and Social VR, and I was having a lot of fun just exploring around a lot of the first person shooter type of games. But I did notice that there would always be like these hacker people coming in and like being able to jump extra high, or just felt like at a certain point they would, or like clipping through walls, or just cheating, it felt like. And so I don't know if that was a persistent battle against the hackers. I know I've
Yeah.
experienced them in my own encounters in Rec Room, but was that like a systemic problem?
Yeah, it definitely was at a certain point. Like when you're on PC, the ability for anyone to just go in and alter files or intercept like stuff going to our servers or route around something is very high. All the problems with hackers we had almost exclusively came from people on PCs. Like it's very hard to do anything malicious or at that level on like a PlayStation or a Switch. It's almost impossible. But if you're on a PC and you're modifying all the files and you're tracing all these things and you're pulling down the build and reverse engineering it and changing these things and connecting with a different client, like there's so many crazy things you can do on PC. And as someone who ran the trust and safety team for a while, like it does become a big problem because it starts to work against kind of like creator confidence in the stability of the app. They're like, hey, this guy came in and he's ruining my game. And like everyone left the world. Why am I going to create more worlds or more rooms and try to monetize them if these people can just come in and totally ruin the experience? And you're like, yeah, fair enough. We're on it. We're going to try to find it. And we would prioritize the issues that were happening at a larger scale affecting the top rooms, that sort of stuff. And then, something would truly be prioritized if it was hitting monetization in any way, right? Like, oh, people found a way to just spawn tokens. And if those tokens can be used to just unlock every avatar item or start paying creators, and then we have to take those tokens back because they were maliciously earned or hacked or whatever, like that's a very bad look. So it was a constant triage against the hackers, and you have to prioritize the ones that are like more damaging to the economy and to, like the larger rooms or whatever. Like we want to solve all of them ideally, but when you've got someone who's like, hey, there's one guy who ruined my room that has 10 visitors a day, you're like, that sucks. We're going to try to, fix that. And then you have someone that's like, hey, I've got a room that's making thousands of dollars a month. I'm using this for a living, and I've got 20 instances of the room open every day with thousands of users, and like somebody's seriously fucking with that room. We just have to prioritize that one, essentially.
Right. Yeah, I think the one, I don't know if I was ever in those top rooms. I would encounter enough of them that I stopped going in, because it was just felt like the balancing of it was just like, well, they're using hacks to defeat me. It's not a fair game. So it just, I mean, I also, there's a skill, like a spectrum of skills. And so I would never know whether or not they were just better than me, which is often the case. The people who got hundreds and hundreds of, maybe even thousands of more hours than me in some of these games, but
Yeah.
sometimes it definitely was like, okay, they're doing stuff that I know for sure that I can't do,
Yeah.
jumping extra high, or I don't know if they were using aimbot or whatnot, but yeah. So experientially, it was always a bit of a bummer to run into some of those hackers.
Yeah, I mean, there were occasionally bugs that weren't even hackers. It was just something wrong with the rec room code where, like, we had this recurring bug in paintball where people would become invincible. They would, like, respawn wrong and then you couldn't get them out and everyone would get super frustrated and they'd, like, have to leave the room or everyone would just be shouting at them. And through no fault of their own, they're just like, I didn't try to do this. It just happened to me. And everyone's like, get out of the room. You're ruining the game, you know?
Right.
And we would always feel bad and then try to track down the bug and squash it again. But yeah, there were some things that weren't even intentional that would just happen to people just because of how complex, the code base became.
And another thing I would encounter would be any room that had a microphone. They would inevitably at some point get people onto the microphone, broadcasting to the entire room, like the most gross, disgusting, racist things. That would happen more often than not. And so I was wondering if Rec Room ever tried to figure out a way to deal with that, or just realize that having the ability to broadcast to everyone was just sort of a recipe for that type of racist trolling. Or yeah, I'm just curious to hear any reflections on that.
Yeah, those rooms were fun when there weren't trolls in them because a lot of those rooms, you have a microphone, and then the creator of the room can wire the mic into like just like global throughout the whole room. And it's typically a room where it's like a PvP kind of like, you're battling it out, and then there's like a radio broadcast tower, and everyone wants to seize the tower and then like say whatever stupid thing they want over the microphone. And like in an ideal scenario, it's really fun and it creates a fun dynamic where everyone's trying to like seize the radio tower. In the worst case, you have, obviously people come into the room and they hear like, oh, I can say whatever I want and everyone has to listen to it. And, the worst thing pops into their head because a lot of them are teenage boys and, that's just the brain chemistry of teenage boys is to like say the craziest thing. The initial system we put in place to deal with that, because I don't even think we had this in the beginning, was you could see who was chatting. So if you opened up the player menu, you could check where the mic activity was coming from in the room, and then you could report that person, say, hey, in this room, they got on the radio and said this terrible thing. If we get enough of those reports or reports from like a highly trusted enough person, then we just ban them. So that doesn't save you in the moment, but it does remove it from future use cases. The only way you're going to get action in the moment is if you have like such a highly trusted person there, which we did make. Like there were a number of moderators we would deputize, and they would just go through the most popular instances and just instantly ban or kick people as they heard stuff like that. So you do have that, but like your coverage isn't perfect for an app with, millions of users. And then the only other way to deal with that at scale is through like sampling of voice audio and then having a system take action on those samples. Or you're sampling more often people who are getting reported more often. So if everyone in the room reports the person and then we do a 30-second sample of the audio and then we determine they're saying something against the code of conduct, you can action on that pretty quickly. But And we did implement those systems like in the last few years of Rec Room. We had quite a robust trust and safety, automation infrastructure there. But, at the point you were playing like pre-pandemic, we probably didn't have that system online yet.
Yeah, and I'm just curious if you could give me some sense of the scale of the users now that you're going to be shutting down. Do you have any like peak concurrent or peak monthly users that you had at Rec Room?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly in the tens of millions of monthly active users at its peak. I forget the exact peak, but it might have been somewhere in the like 20, 30, potentially even 40 million range.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Across
And
all the devices.
that's adding everything up together. And there would be huge spikes during like the winter holidays. You see a bunch of devices come online like on Christmas and the few days after. Like Christmas to the first week of January is just like crazy high usage. We would see that consistently. And then during the summer, usage would go up quite a lot as well because everyone's out of school. So summer and winter break was always a great time to check our charts.
Gotcha. And do you have any personal favorite memories of Rec Room?
Yeah, I was actually just looking at all of my rec.net photos, like the in-game photos you take. And just for anyone who has played Rec Room ever, I would go to rec.net, log in, and download all your photos. Someone who's still there created a full kind of like batch download service where you just go in and it zips all the photos up for you and download onto your PC. So I downloaded all of mine and I was looking through them and, I was hitting so many moments where I was like, oh yeah, we had that birthday party for so and so. And this was like the first player created room I ever went into and toured around with this guy. So it's like I was getting very nostalgic over all of those moments, just looking at those photos. I mean, I guess if I had to pick out, do you mean particular moments in game or like in the life of the company?
Oh, either. I was thinking in the game, but if you have other moments too, I'd be just be curious to kind of do a little bit of a memory capture of these peak moments that you've had in your time at Rec
Yeah.
Room.
I mean, one that stands out to me big time was we were just in the Rec Room office, like one of our first offices. On Wall Street in Seattle. And this was the day that we turned on the ability for anyone to buy rec tokens. So at all my previous startups, we had never really monetized in a serious way. So just watching a chart of like the money come in and be like, wow, someone likes the thing we built enough to like pay for it was like, it was like a huge moment for me as a entrepreneur startup guy. I was like, we did it. We made revenue. There's money coming in. Like people are paying us for this thing we built. It felt really good because yeah, everything else I'd ever built, I had just done for free or, Converge was largely a labor of just like love. We like to build it. We like the community. We like to do the updates. We've raised a tiny amount of money from Y Combinator, but not really. But that's not people giving you money because they like the thing you built. That's like an investor saying this might make us more money in the future. It's a very different feeling than like people love Rec Room so much they want to support us with like buying a subscription or a service. That was like a very exciting moment for me. So I definitely remember that. And there's just a lot of great moments in the early days of Rec Room 2 where, you ship a new quest especially, and like everyone gets so psyched for like, oh my God, Jumbotron or whatever the new quest is, everyone freaks out. And we got a lot of press coverage back then every time we shipped a new RRO. I remember at one point, Norm from Tested came through the office and was playing like one of the new quests before it came out. And I'd watched a lot of the Tested videos for the last few years up to that point, and I was like, wow, like Norm's here and he's talking about our game. That's so cool. That was another moment. And the cool thing about that original office, the first one I was in, I think the original like six Rec Room co-founders and maybe one or two other people that had an office before that in a WeWork, but it wasn't like a real office. So when I say the first Rec Room office, I mean the first one that existed in my head. That one was on top of a like a Fender showcase studio. So they had all these guitars and musical instruments everywhere. And we would just be working, and then at like 5 or 6 o'clock, you would just hear like drums and somebody just like shredding on a guitar, or like a whole band would just start playing. And there was like an almost like a little atrium in the middle of the office where you could look down into the lower one and you could just like see people playing just like beautiful music. And you're just like sitting there designing VR stuff and you're just listening to world-class music. And then you're like, who was that? And they're like, oh, that's legendary guitarist so and so was here. And you're like, that's sick. Like that was one of my favorite parts of being in that office that I'll remember. I have a lot of videos of just like I would just record down through that little kind of like atrium way, and then I have a lot of like, since one of my focuses at film school was like documentary work, I just have extensive like photos and videos of all this sort of stuff. So I always like to go back and look at that and get very nostalgic about those things. But yeah, I'll have to think more about moments in game that were super like moving to me. I mean, we had the wedding that happened that we got covered in Wired magazine, which was a big moment too. Like there was a Wired write-up and it was like in the magazine itself, and it was about a couple that had, I believe, met in Rec Room and then got married. Like they had their service in Rec Room, which everyone always loves a virtual wedding story. You know, like Second Life has multiple of these, and I'm sure VR Chat has some, but everyone, it's such a great like piece of press everyone likes to point to. Like, can you believe these crazy nerds had their wedding in whatever
Right.
location? So we got one of those, which felt like a kind of like a hallmark moment for having created a virtual world.
Yeah, for me, when I think about Rec Room, I just popped in maybe for the last time since it's closing next week and I'm going to be traveling off and on before then. But the music is something that I think Cameron did a great job. And I saw a YouTube video that there's been some albums that Cameron's been releasing. I might have to download some of the soundtrack because I think the music really takes me back. But yeah, for me, the dorm room PvP room was one that I always enjoyed because it was like a one shot room where you would only have to shoot people once. But it's also very tiny and all the guns were very easily grabbable. Sometimes you would pick a PvP room and just to even get a weapon, it was a challenge. Especially if you had enough people there that would be kind of hoarding all the weapons. And another one that I really enjoyed was the Insane Room PvP. And there was another one that was a meme-based PvP with like a giant Kermit and other things that then, but then they changed it. So then when I was trying to like go back to be like to visit it, they had significantly altered it in a way that was like, wow, this is already shifting in a way that, you know, they had changed it over the years. But I was at least able to go back to some of my old favorite stomping grounds and kind of have a few rounds and yeah, so there was just some of my favorite worlds that I would just pop into and sometimes I during the pandemic, sometimes I would like pull an all-nighter just like playing with people from around the world and I was less communicative. It was more of like a way for me to go and be like a solo in a social environment. It's much more challenging to kill other you know, people in a VR game than it is other bots. And so it was always like a skill, like more the one of the more challenging ones, but also more casual, not like the other sort of hardcore shooters that are out there. And so it was always kind of like a fun casual shooter that seemed to have enough of a critical mass of people playing it that I could have a range of people that would be better than me and that I would be better than some people. So it was always I always kind of found myself maybe in the middle or maybe slightly not even quite at the middle, but it was still fun to play extended amounts of time and playing some of those PvP games and probably some of my most, you know, and so as it's going away, I found myself feeling sad that I'm not going to be able to pop into those rooms anymore, even if I hadn't gone in there for maybe a year or two.
The like loss of even being able to connect to Rec Room and log in is going to feel really weird to me. Like right now I understand that the servers will shut down on June 1st, but like until I try to access Rec Room and I get a message that's like this app doesn't even exist anymore or the servers are down, like it's hard to really like feel it. So I know there's probably like an emotional like reckoning coming for me, but right now I'm just trying to like, yeah, document stuff. You can they created a avatar exporter, so you can export your avatar with all the clothes they're wearing. So I went and exported all of my saved outfits. They created a full room exporter, so people can export their rooms into like something you can open up in Unity or pull into VR Chat or whatever other thing you want to try to pull it into. So I think that's great. Like the team clearly felt bad about the shutdown and wanted to allow people to bring as much stuff out as they could. But this is also, like the platform risk any creator takes when they build an audience or a living anywhere is like that thing might not last forever. Like if YouTube, for some crazy reason, like, it's Google, so it's not going to happen. But like if YouTube shuts down, like imagine what that does to all those people's living, right? They're like, I thought YouTube would be around forever. Like, oh, there go all your subscribers, download all your videos, blah, blah, blah. Like, if you thought Rec Room was as stable as YouTube, like that's how you're feeling right now.
Yeah, it's a bit of a cultural history as well on YouTube, but also in Rec Room, just like having the ability to have access to it in a way that could maybe be pure, like a server that people are hosting on their own. So it sounds like there are some tools that were created. Like, what are those tools, and how do you get access to them? How if people are listening to this ahead of that, if they want to export, like where do people go to find that?
Yeah, I think if you just Google like Rec Room export tool, like there's a blog post that I think Rec Room put out officially saying, here's our tool. There might be third party ways to grab stuff, but I'm guessing the tool that Rec Room released is probably the best, like easiest one to use. So I would just go look for the Rec Room blog post where they list all the tools that they built. I think it came out along with the news of the shutdown, like, hey, we're shutting down, here's all the tools. Or it came out like a week later. They were like, hey, we're working on the tools, you'll see it shortly. But it should all be in the blog or in like social posts that people could find pretty easily.
And were you a part of one of the rounds of layoffs, or are you still? I think I saw that you were no longer with Rec Room, but what was the story of how your relationship or time there at Rec Room ended?
Yeah, I left in late last year, so in like October. But yeah, up to that point, like we had done some cuts and we had lost some people from the creator team that I was running. And then yeah, as we got closer and closer to the shutdown, just losing more and more people. So that's kind of how it started going towards the end was it's tough to be at a company and be losing people that you've worked with, especially people you work with for a long time that were there for, in some cases, like towards from the very beginning, you're losing them. And it's quite a morale shock. And the people who are left, they do want to, try to, keep things going and find growth and save the company and do more with who's left. But it's hard to regain the like sense of just like as much motivation as you had when everything was going like amazing, right? Like those are the best times. Like the peak metaverse hype times were amazing. And then as you're starting to be like, uh-oh, we might have a an issue here if we're laying people off, it just creates more kind of like tension. We did one layoff, we don't want to do another one, and then you have to do another one, and then it just creates a tough environment.
Well, it definitely feels like we're in a bit of a liminal space of like the end of an era, lots of different ways of, Facebook, Meta stepping back from Horizon Worlds, and just feels like we're in a transitional liminal space, almost like a beginning of a new cycle as AI is coming up. But so I feel like that Rec Room was sort of at a of the moment in a lot of ways of kind of riding the very early waves of virtual reality gaming and kind of really found a niche of this kind of social VR platform. So given all that kind of unique moment in history and time and riding the zeitgeists of the moment, just curious if you have any reflections on like lessons learned from, like what you think Rec Room learned around the quintessential nature of social VR or, this medium. It feels like it's, capitalism is certainly a big part of the overarching system that is driving a lot of this. But if you have any sort of deeper insights in terms of what you're personally taking away or what you think some of the lessons learned from Rec Room might be as people move forward into the future and maybe start to recreate some of the spirit of Rec Room, like advice or things that you would send a little message in a bottle to the future of things that you learned along the way?
Yeah. I mean, I can't speak for the company as a whole, but like the lessons learned for me personally, I would say one of them is like for Rec Room, being on as many platforms as we were on was very beneficial. Like the power of being able to get into Rec Room and hang out with your friends on almost any major gaming device or any device that you can possibly play a game on. Like that was a huge superpower for Rec Room, being that cross-platform and being able to play with anyone. It was also a huge hindrance in that if you want everyone to be able to play with each other, you have to ship updates in sync with every platform. And shipping updates in sync, especially on a weekly or every 2 weeks cadence, was like became very rough on the team at a certain point. Especially when you're like, all right, we're shipping, and then Apple holds you up for 3, 4, 5 days, and now you've got some platforms that you have already shipped to, and you're all the iOS people are like, why can't I hang out with my friends? And you're like, oh shit, it's because Apple's holding us up. And just like, you know, dealing with all the platform stuff was rough. And then especially the aspiration to allow creation on any device was like a huge chunk of work and potentially wasn't even worth it. Like it's a great aspiration, and like ideally if you can get people creating high quality rooms on mobile or on their PlayStation, like that's awesome, but I don't know if it was worth it in the end given the amount of people we put on it and time and effort versus like what if we had just kept creation on like PC screens and VR headsets? Like that might have been a better path. Like we might have been able to spend more time on other projects that would have led to better results for us than like having to maintain those 12 platforms and the MakerPen UI across all those platforms and push forward on room quality on all those platforms. So definitely taking away one of the lessons for me is like supporting all those platforms can be like incredibly good for your network effects and the social dynamics, but it can also be incredibly tough on the like team to support all of them and to like try to have a good experience on all of them and whatever new thing you're shipping. So yeah, it's like it's a weird tension there between like the benefits and then the downsides of supporting all those platforms. I mean, another tough lesson I learned is just how much pushback you will get from the community whenever you try to monetize anything. Like Rec Room was a free game for like 3 or 4 years. We asked nothing of anyone. It was all free. Everything we did for the first 4 years, here's an amazing game, an amazing community. We're paying all the server costs, everything out of the investment we've taken. And then we're like, here's Rec tokens. Would anyone like to support us by buying Rec tokens? And like some people did, like I was saying, and it felt great. But then there was a huge pushback immediately. People are like, you're just like EA. You're such a greedy corporation, you pieces of shit. And I'm like, come on, bro. Like it's optional. You don't even have to buy the tokens. Like if you don't want avatar items from us, you don't have to. But they're still upset that we're even giving other people the ability to like support the company and keep the lights on and whatever. So dealing with that, I found incredibly frustrating. That's something I tried to not comment on as much while I was at Rec Room, but now that I'm gone, it's very cathartic to be like designing for gamers, especially when you're trying to monetize, is like super frustrating. You know, they're like, you know, you go look at somebody's account who's like, you guys are the devil and I hate you all for, you know, charging someone $2 for an avatar item. And then you look at their account and they've got like 3,000 hours played for free on the thing. And you're like, thanks, bro. Like, sure, enjoy your 3,000 hours for free and get mad when somebody else buys a $2 hat to support the company. Like that shit drove me crazy.
Yeah, there were some games that were kind of pay to win type of things. So if people were buying stuff, it would sort of change the balancing. But yeah, buying cosmetic things should not be as controversial. That's sort of a challenge of monetization is the pay to win type of
thing. I mean, My rebuke to that even is like, don't play that game. If we give a creator the option, it's very hard for us to monitor every room and be like, if you have an in-app purchase in your room that creates slightly unfair gameplay or whatever, we're gonna stop you from doing that. Like, if players want to play a power game where you can just pay to win, like they chose to play that game, somebody chose to buy the thing, like I don't know what to tell you. Don't play that room.
I would slowly, not play those rooms as much, but there were some instances of that dynamic of paying to change the gameplay, which I could see having arguments at. But yeah, people buying avatar items, certainly not as controversial. I did want to ask a question around like this larger ecosystem, because Meta is sort of like on the side doing their own thing, and in a lot of ways, Rec Room is a competitor to what they were trying to create with Horizon Worlds. And there was a memo that Mark Zuckerberg sent out on June 22nd, 2015 at 10:54 a.m. It was called VR AR Strategy in One. And this was it's on TechCrunch. If you search on Google for Zuckerberg and Facebook considering and mulling over whether or not they should buy Unity. And in this memo, Zuckerberg's basically saying that, I think you can divide the ecosystem into three major parts: app experiences, platform services, and hardware platform and services, and then hardware systems. And my vision of ubiquitous AR VR, these are listed in order of importance, although it's worth noting that Apple has built the world's most valuable company with a high-end vision by reversing that order. So in other words, he's saying that first-party apps and experiences are the most lucrative part of the XR business, and that supporting the platform and services, which would mean that supporting the broader ecosystem, supporting like if Meta doing explicit support for a company like Rec Room, it seems to me that as I look back, that Meta was trying to build their own thing that I could imagine that they would not necessarily be happy that there'd be other apps on their platform like VR Chat or Rec Room that would be in some ways way more popular than their own social VR platform. Did you notice any evidence of that in terms of like things that they could have done or things that they were maybe explicitly doing that were, I don't know, there's been some anti-competitive behaviors they were doing for other companies, but just curious if there were some opportunities lost at Meta, if they would have decided to support the ecosystem first, if they could have, maybe marketed or changed the dynamic or conversation. Because at a certain point, they start like really promoting their own Horizon Worlds even more than the third-party apps that were on the store. And I have to imagine that that also had to play in some part of the, the eventual fates of Rec Room. But curious to hear any of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, it is a weird position to be in where they're sitting on top of all of the deep platform analytics that even we don't have. They're like, they have insight into Rec Room that like even we potentially don't have for Oculus only, like not across everything, right? They don't know what our user numbers are on any other platform, but like for Oculus in particular, they can see they have just like an incredible amount of insight there. And I think probably what they noticed over time, which naturally anyone would, is like the retention really looks good on like VR Chat and Rec Room and these social experiences because you play, you go in and you play Super Hot or whatever game it is, and it's fun, and maybe you revisit it every so often, but mostly you play a game and you finish it, and then you go play another game and you finish it. But it's like, what are people consistently booting on their device to like regularly return to? And it's, I think in a lot of cases, it's social interactions, right? It's like, I've heard at one point that like poker VR was doing very good numbers. Like people would be in there pretty often and they were spending a lot of money on it too. So it makes sense to me if you're looking at all that data from their perspective, you're like, and it's obvious too, right? You're Facebook, so you want a social product. So either you're gonna potentially buy one of those or you're gonna build your own. And I think they clearly made the decision to build their own. And they've been doing social experiments with like under Facebook ever since the like toy box demo, right? Like, did you do the toy box demo?
It's one of the most mind-blowing experience demos I've seen.
It was incredible. But like, even at that point, and they had so many iterations, right? They had, what was it, Spaces? They launched that at one point. They had something else called like Rooms or something. I forget what it was. And then they had another one. Like they would every year or two, they would crank out some new social thing. They'd be like, check this out. And then they would slot like quietly wind it down. I think everyone knew they were going to do something there. And then I think they saw what Rec Room was doing in particular and liked it, and then created something very similar. I think it's hard to look at Horizon Worlds and not see that's exactly what happened. And I think it's flattering to some extent, right? You're like, oh wow, they've clearly modeled this thing pretty heavily off of how Rec Room operates. I mean, there were signs we had at Rec Room that was something that was happening. Like there were things I don't want to get into explicitly, but we were like, oh, they seem very interested in like how our tools work. I think I think they liked the kind of like just the creation ecosystem that Rec Room had built out.
Yeah, I'm sort of connecting some dots there just in terms of the from the point before Horizon Worlds was launched and then afterwards, and just yeah, someone, I think it was Darshan Shankar, said to me that Facebook is sort of a company that does a lot of like engineering, but not as much game design. And so they'll be
Yeah,
like trying to
clearly.
engineer towards something, but not really kind of organically develop something in their own sort of sense of experiential design. So they're kind of like, I think, using Rec Room as a template potentially when they were looking at Rec Room or looking at their Horizon Worlds. Yeah, I think there was like what the way that Darshan said is that, yeah, when you're trying to own the metaverse, then you get kind of like more of an engineering approach rather than a game design approach, which I think is
Yes.
like they're it's a different type of design, experiential design chops that I think it was clear to me that Rec Room had that endemically, but that Facebook and Meta and the folks at Horizon Worlds never really had that same type of thing where you can kind of get the sense of the people that were building it would never actually play it, and that like they were like building it to spec, but not really building it for themselves. They weren't really necessarily eating their own dog food. You get this sense of like this is just what they've been assigned to, but they're not like passionate about it. And I think it could you can feel it when you kind of get this soulless feeling of going into Horizon Worlds. But anyway, I think that's a part of the larger ecosystem of what happened, I think, over the last, you know, from my perspective of an kind of an independent analyst and hearing all the different people talking about the ways that Meta would sort of prioritize their own first party apps. And I think we see a lot of evidence of that over that. And now I think they're taking a step away from those first party apps. And now as we start in this new cycle, I think we're going to hopefully see an opportunity for more of a flourishing where Meta's not trying to directly compete with some of the biggest players.
I mean, I'm sure there are people that were and maybe still are on the Horizon team that do enjoy the thing and they want it to do well and they feel, passionate about it, but it always seemed like it lacked a like true kind of cohesive vision for what it wanted to be and any amount of like style or just like clear kind of like artistic direction, or for lack of a better word, like vibes. Like Rec Room has very clear kind of like art style and vibes and like world building happening inside it. It's a university. There are people we reference that run different parts of the university. It just has a certain feeling to it. And Horizon just never had like that sense of, I don't know, just like picking a definitive style. It was all just kind of I don't know, a little bland and general, and it seemed like they were unwilling to take any sort of creative risks, essentially, right? Like
Yeah, it felt like a view from nowhere. It was basically like they were trying to engineer something that they thought other people might like, but it wasn't something that they were inherently interested in. There's an amazing Rick Rubin quote where he says that he's not really necessarily even interested in what the audience think. He's only creating stuff for his own satisfaction. And it just so happens that
what he's satisfied by, like really pure good art, other people also happen to enjoy. And I don't feel like that Meta was doing that, like creating art for art's sake. It was creating something that they thought other people might like, but didn't really have that character or soul or personality or a perspective or any kind of interesting character to it. It just felt empty and just like designed and architected for an idea of what people might want. But I don't think that I certainly did not experience that within Rec Room. It felt like it had a very like a clear perspective as to like a voice, and it felt like more artistic in that sense. And so it felt like a place that had a unique character that was making very deliberate design choices and personality in a way that I didn't see in anything that Meta ever did. So anyway, I think when I look at the two, I can definitely appreciate what Rec Room was able to accomplish, because when you see a big corporation attempted to replicate it, the magic of it, they never really were able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a huge shout out to Cam for all of the, like you said, the music I think plays a huge part, and then just the art, the initial art direction that like Ryan, our kind of like head of art, applied to it was just incredible. Like, he had an amazing vision. And then Terrence, who led all of our concept art stuff, like Terrence and Ryan and that early art team would just jam on stuff, and it came out incredible, you know, like Golden Trophy, Jumbotron, all those things. It's just like really inspiring work, in my opinion. So it was definitely like a privilege to get to watch the team consistently ship these things that were just like mind-blowing experiences.
Do you know if because there's a lot of first-party apps of the Rec Room originals, are any of those going to be downloaded and made available in any fashion? Do you know?
Yeah, it's a interesting question. I don't know what they're going to do with those. My guess is there might be some sort of like restriction on what can happen with those based on, you know, how they're winding the company down or what stuff went over to, because a portion of the people at Rec Room, and I think some of the, like maybe some of the patents and other IP stuff, I'm not even sure, went to Snap. So it's possible they are limited and can't do something with those. But if they could open source them and just like let people download it, turn it into whatever, that'd be cool.
So Snap was involved in getting some of the assets?
I think they got more than just the people. I'm not even sure. I'm not sure on the details of that. Okay. But I think somebody did some reporting where Nick might have said something along those lines, but I haven't read it in detail. I just assume they bought more than the people that went over there.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well, I guess as we start to wrap up, I'd love to hear what you think the ultimate potential of XR and these different types of social experiences might be, and what it might be able to enable.
I don't know, man. I think it's like, for me, it's always the social element. Like, I think the ultimate potential is in the eye of the beholder. So it's like, I remember you asked this question of Hayden and I the first time we came on, and Hayden was like, it's the Matrix, it's a sci-fi thing, that's the ultimate potential. And I'm like a fantasy nerd, so I'm like, it's a fantasy world where you can do whatever Sword Art Online like crazy fantasy thing you want. So I think it's like the ultimate potential is just whatever thing you think XR is going to lead to that you want the most. So for me, it's just like amazing social experiences. Like, I was thinking about this the other day. I've been playing a lot of Overwatch recently, and like purely through text chat in Overwatch, I've met some cool people. Like, I add them to my battle.net friends list, and I play with them over multiple nights, and I get to know them just purely through text chat. And it's like, that's an amazing experience to have, just like connecting with someone and playing games with them, and you feel like camaraderie. And it's like, man, if you can start to nail that, you know, in VR, and I think maybe not as game-based, but some people clearly have, like Rec Room did. I think VR chat is doing a great job at that sort of stuff. Like, the, I don't know, after all of my rec room experiences, like the one thing that's clear to me after having left the company is like the most valuable thing I did the whole time was just like meet a bunch of cool people and stay in touch with them. Like all the people that reached out when I left and all the people I'm talking to now about working on new projects together, like these are all people I wouldn't have met without my rec room like time, right? Like the human relationships and the bonds you make with people while you're there is the most valuable part, because like rec room's going away, you won't be able to play it anymore. Like I learned the skills and some whatever from being at rec room. I leveled up my career, but like the thing I would like be most hesitant to give up are those human connections. And like as much as VR and any technology allows me to maintain those connections with people, like that's the most valuable thing to me.
And what are you working on now? Have you announced your next frontier of work?
I haven't. Everyone asks me, they're like, what's your next VR thing? And I'm like, listen, it's been, freaking 13 years or whatever. Like maybe I'll take a break from VR, right? Like not to say I would never work in it again, but like after 13 years, you kind of want to like try something else. And especially being at Rec Room, the thing that I found super interesting was working on especially mobile apps. When we launched on mobile, like the ability to drive traffic to the app store through like the user acquisitions and like advertising I was doing and refining these things so that it's like, oh, if you have this sort of creative that you place on YouTube or in the App Store ads, it'll do this well. And you can, we got people downloading the app for 50 cents, like cost per install. And then this is what the lifetime value of the user looks like. And like refining that to the point where it's like, oh, wow, you could create almost any app. And with like a modest budget, you could get thousands of people to try it. And they just look at a dashboard and be like, is there anything here? Do people like this? Is anyone coming back? And if it looks really promising, like you can just keep spending money. And if you've made anything valuable, like you can just keep doing that. So I've got a few things I'm working on that are, a lot of them are in the like mobile space. And I'm just eager to kind of like do a bunch of tests and see what works for like pretty cheap. I'm not trying to, raise $10 million and build some crazy thing.
Right. 'Cause you were kind of in charge of a lot of the influencer relations at Rec Room, is that right?
Yeah, the I did all of our creation of the video partner program, and then I did all of our influencer spending. So I've had some people reach out to me for that sort of work, which has been interesting. I've been doing some like contracting there on the side, but I'm definitely looking forward to like, after like when I joined Rec Room, it was kind of a sidetrack for me to like starting my own thing. I was like, I'm either going to start my own thing or do this. And I didn't expect I'd be there for 8.5 years. Like I thought it would be a much shorter tenure than that and I'd go do something else. So now I'm very much in like founder mode. So I've
Gotcha.
had a bunch of people be like, hey, you should join our team and do this. And I'm like, I don't listen, I deferred it already for like almost a decade. So I really just got to get back to it.
A good time to be starting something with something new, just because it does feel like we're in this liminal kind of transition state. There's kind of like a more than any other time that I've been covering the XR industry. It's more uncertain and almost boundless to see where our creative imagination takes us. AI is certainly a big part of the overall conversation, but yeah, I still have a lot of faith that now that Meta is taking a step back, that there's going to be a chance for a more organic growth to happen in the XR industry without trying to have the hyperscalers get it to a certain level. And so yeah, so it sounds like that you're able to kind of go back into that founder mode and kind of do that entrepreneurial thing you've been aspiring to for a long time.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How do you feel about like the XR space? Like you've invested so much of your time and documenting all these things, and then like when the Rec Room shutdown news came out and when the Horizon news came out, I feel like there was a renewed wave of like it's so over, like do you feel that?
So I've been covering a lot of the immersive storytelling and location-based entertainment. And so I think in those spaces, you're seeing a lot of like kind of flourishing of things like Excurio and models where people are actually going out to these locations and having like an immersive storytelling or immersive tour experience in groups. So I just wrote a 121 page report for IFA Doc Lab that's basically like recounting like a whole revolution of indie XR distribution. So with Meta stepping back, it's basically like actually creating these cultural institutions, these location-based entertainment. There's this whole movement of people that I think are starting up that's kind of like taking where like things like The Void and other places, but really having less of a VR arcade and more of a immersive storytelling. So Fi and Montreal, and there's lots of really kind of interesting stuff. So I spent a lot of time going and seeing what the artists are doing at places like South by Southwest Immersive and Venice Immersive. There used to be Tribeca Immersive and Sundance Immersive, those have like, or Sundance New Frontier. Those have kind of taken a step back, but Venice Immersive, IFA Doc Lab, and there's more and more new images, and Cannes Immersive just happened. And so there's more and more of these kind of premier film festivals where you really see the cutting edge of immersive storytelling. So I love going and seeing what those artists are doing. And when I see those experiences, I'm like, oh yeah, this is totally going to have this phase of this kind of organic growth. So I see that people are kind of getting off the internet is what the theme was at IFA Doc Lab. People kind of getting tired of being controlled algorithmically and just AI slop on social media. They want to see other humans and be together. Yeah. So the creative impact industries, a creative immersive impact industries coalition, CCCC out of Netherlands, has like $200 million that they're investing into different kind of emerging XR industries, some of which are immersive storytelling, but they're giving artists a whole lot of money to collaborate with researchers to figure out how could you use both XR and immersive storytelling and experiential design more broadly, independent of technologies, to be able to revitalize civic society. So you have really interesting things where you have artists collaborating with researchers to see how can you bring people together to kind of like revitalize what it means to be a democracy and be face to face with each other. So there's some really interesting experiments like that I'm really interested in seeing. AWE is going to start to bring in some of this immersive storytelling that has typically been like very enterprisey, but you're going to see some of that at AWE coming up. So those are the things that I get excited about. I've always been kind of more, not so much into the gaming, but not so much in the enterprise, but more of the artistic and arts and culture and storytelling. So, and also I'm very driven philosophically. So I think there's still a lot of really rich kind of philosophical questions around the nature of experiential design, the different interdisciplinary fusion that's happening across bringing all these disciplines together. And so I think we're kind of at a level of maturity where you've had a little bit of this first phase of VR has been to kind of figure out all the best practices. And now what are the things that are going to actually take root as we're planting seeds, as we're moving into the future? Well, we're kind of in a moment right now where, I don't know if you've watched the movie called BlackBerry, but in 2007, that's when the iPhone came out. And there's a whole really great, Canadian film called BlackBerry where people at BlackBerry kind of missed the boat and they pretty much went away. They're no longer like one of the top mobile phone companies. So Nokia and BlackBerry, they missed the smartphone revolution, right? So I think that we're in this moment where all these companies are terrified that they're going to be the next BlackBerry and Nokia, where they don't get onto the AI hype train and they're going to be left behind. Yep. So there's a certain amount of speculative investment that's happening with AI that ends up being like a lot of circular investment. I think there's a big AI bubble that's driven by fear of these big tech companies not wanting to miss the next big thing, because, you know, with smartphones, it ended up being Apple and Google, and there's like the top two. And then, you know, being third place is basically being last. And, you know, it's like either you're one or two. And so I think a lot of these companies are aspiring to be the number one or two. But just like what Rec Room faced with, like, you had this Roomy thing that was super popular, but you had people using way more compute than they were paying. And that's basically what you have in AI right now, where all of these companies are not doing purchase. Like people are not paying for the tokens they're actually using. So they're taking all this loss leader because they want to get like enough of capture of the audience so that they could be one of those top two. But right now they're just draining, like it's so expensive and they're just draining all this money. So I feel like there is a lot of this moment where the entire industry is in this place of not of moving out of fear, investing in AI. I do think that AI is going to be a huge thing, but I don't necessarily think the business models have been necessarily sorted out in a way that makes it sustainable. And that we also have this countervailing effect of the open source. So either you're going to go the closed model or you're going to go open model. And so I'm more of like, you know, looking back to the early days of the internet of like, let's go back to that. Let's go back to RSS feeds and email newsletters and open protocol and Blue Sky. I feel like there's a lot of the spirit of trying to revitalize what it means to be an emancipatory and liberatory technology ecosystem. But right now it just feels like these billionaire tech capitalists and trillionaire companies, soon to be trillionaires, that are going to be like controlling and manipulating us. And I think there's a certain backlash that people are like not wanting to be on technology at all. And so I do think that XR has the capability to kind of provide that off-ramp of the antidote to our addictions to our phones in a way that actually gives people visceral embodied lived experiences. So that's, that's where I give a lot of hope and see like, and focus on and coverage.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that's, it's a weird counterintuitive thing where like so much technology is actually better than, you know, like being in a headset fully immersed with other people for like 2 hours playing games and socializing is like a very deeply technology enabled experience, but it's also like more satisfying to me than like scrolling TikTok for 2 hours, right? Like I would feel worse having done the TikTok thing. And like, but if you put two of those phones together in a headset, you know, a quarter inch from my eyeballs, it's actually a much better, like more human experience. Like it's kind of a counterintuitive thing, but like the result of like how you feel afterwards. And it also is more focused, right? Like you're having a lot of the time, just like one experience, you're in one app talking to a group of people. It is a, in some ways, especially for younger people, a more focused experience where there are less distractions, right? You're not checking your phone while you're hanging out with your friends. You're not doing whatever. Like you're purely there. Like it's almost a hack to like keep you in the moment.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. And I do think that both AI and XR are kind of in this like new paradigm of computing. But at the same time, what's the new economic business model to kind of match that new paradigm? And I don't necessarily think that we've achieved that yet. I just did an interview with Joseph Pine about the transformation economy. He wrote a whole book about the experience economy. And so I do think that, you know, I do think that we're moving into an era where people are wanting to have meaningful, filled with purpose and enabling flourishing and also allowing people to achieve their aspirations and ultimately have life-changing experiences with the different types of time that they're using, whatever app or experience that they're having. And so I do feel like that if people are able to kind of find that niche of providing a transformative experience where people are able to live into their aspirations and achieve a deep level of human flourishing, like that, like philosophically, that's certainly where we're going to go. The business models around that may end up looking more around like Patreon or kind of like, you know, you pay, you know, his Joe Pine's big idea is that you pay after you've had a transformation. So after you have a transformation, then you have a transformative experience, then you somehow pay back. And I think that's that type of thing that we see maybe in Twitch or other Patreon as a model. And so it's kind of scaling that out at a business level up to like larger and larger scales where you can actually sustain that in a way that it's just not the 1% of people that are giving back, but like more of a, whatever that critical mass of like, you can give this service or experience away for free, but a certain amount of people like pay back. So I think these different types of business models may be driven more by the organic growth rather than, you know, something that doesn't have the kind of hyperscaling like expectations of VC funding that I think maybe outpaced like where XR and AI is ready to be at in order to really achieve that. So I think that having these kind of small businesses that are able to kind of make ends meet, but also kind of organically grow is where I'm more interested in seeing the future of where this is all going.
Yeah. I mean, to quickly inject another lesson in here, I think the watching how much money Rec Room raised and like the burden that became on the company at a certain point in terms of the expectations, that was an interesting lesson for me and something I'm applying to like my current projects. Cause I, you know, as soon as I take any money from anybody, even friends and family, you've now like committed yourself to something, right? You're like, I'm burning their money to build this thing that I believe in. And like, you can't just like walk away from that. I guess you could and then return the cash, but it's like, you know, to take any amount of money, even a small amount, to like get a company started is like, it just puts you in a certain mode. And then if you take a large amount of money from like more institutional investors who are looking for returns on like a certain timeline, and like you pitched them on a certain growth rate, or, you know, it's clear that they would like you to compete with, you know, the larger products in that space. Like when Rec Room is raising $150 million during COVID, during peak metaverse hype, like they're not giving Rec Room that money so that it can become like a nice sustainable lifestyle business for all the employees like 20 years from now, and we're all just like happy to have these great jobs. They're giving us that money so that we can turn it into 10, 50, 100x that value for them. So, you know, that obviously narrows your the paths you can take at a certain point, right? You're like, what, here are all the features we could build. Which one do you think the community would like? Which one do you think we should prioritize? And it's like, there's always that pressure of like, well, we do have all that money in the bank. And, you know, at some point that, you know, those expectations start to creep into the decision making, which, you know, of course they should. Like, if the goal is to start competing and be one of the larger virtual worlds like on the planet, like you just have to operate a certain way at that point. But you've, you know, you, by taking that amount of money, you've locked yourself into that situation.
Right.
But yeah, you know, it's also a incredibly privileged thing to be able to like self-fund something. Like if all the Rec Room co-founders were like incredibly independently wealthy and they had funded the thing themselves, like we'd probably be in a very different position, but that's like super rare. Yeah. So it's just like, if you're trying to run a company at a certain scale and beyond, especially like the way Rec Room grew, when you're on all these devices, like you just need a certain amount of people to maintain all that code and all that infrastructure and design and a trust and safety team, because you've got millions of people. Like you just can't do it below a certain number of people, which necessitates like a certain amount of money you need in the bank for people to feel like it's a stable job. And either you're getting that from investors or you're monetizing incredibly well. And I would say Rec Room is never monetizing like in an insane way, just because, like I said, like people in the Rec Room community would consistently push back on us for trying to even do monetization experiments. We're like, let's try to charge a little more for avatar items. And as soon as you increase that number at all, everyone's just like, Rec Room is greedy. You know, they've got all this money they raised. And, you know, because a lot of them are kids, they don't understand what a valuation is. So they're like, you have $3.5 billion in the bank. Why are you? And I'm like, that's not how it works. We don't have $3 billion. Like some venture capitalist valued us at that rate, and we took the most advantageous rate we could because like we want to maintain more of the company. We actually have like whatever, $100 million in the bank or whatever it is. So it's like, just like a lot of the people in the community don't understand how this works. And then they start spreading these memes, which are like, don't give Rec Room money. And it catches on because it's a bunch of kids and they want to be doing whatever the popular kids are doing. So now you're actively fighting a meme that's like, it's bad to support Rec Room. And then you're like, hey, the company wasn't doing so well, we're gonna have to shut it down. And they're like, this is outrageous, fuck Rec Room. And you're like, you guys started a campaign to not give us any money, and now when the company has to shut down, you're upset. You know, it's like, what's going on here? So I don't know, there's so many, as someone who had to deal with the community a lot, I found that stuff very frustrating, that, you know, it's hard for them to understand from a business perspective, like why Rec Room would make these incredibly logical decisions, like from the internal point of view.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of my math teacher from high school had an equation on top of the blackboard. It said choices equals consequences.
So. Yeah.
You have to deal with your consequences of the choices that were made. So, yeah. Okay, well, is there anything else that's left inside that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
I mean, I would just like to thank everyone who ever played Rec Room or gave us feedback, or especially if you ever supported the company. Like, you know, it was a wild ride, and it definitely wouldn't have happened without a lot of people trying Rec Room. And like, we really did iterate as much as we could on like the feedback we got from the community. So like, in large part, Rec Room became what it became just due to the community just driving us in that direction, right? Like, when it was just a VR app, people would be like, hey, I want to modify Paintball, I want to drop some stuff in there. And we're like, okay, we had no design plans for this at all, but here's a sandbox machine where you can have frisbees in there now. And then they're like, oh, we set up this, you know, ultimate frisbee game and we play it every night, but we can't save the room, so can you let us do that? And we're like, dang, that's going to be complicated. Okay, you can save the room now with like sandbox items. And they're like, we want to modify the amount of damage that the guns do. And we're like, oh man, we're going to need like some sort of scripting or customization tool for that. So like, the community literally shaped Rec Room into what it became, just through giving us constant feedback on like the things they wanted to do with the app. So there's, you know, this is something we said internally all the time, is like, there's no Rec Room without the community. And, you know, it's just like such, I feel very lucky to have gotten to work on something that like reached that scale and like made that impact on that many people's lives. Cause like, I have a Rec Room tattoo. It's the only tattoo I have on the back of my left calf. And I will like go out, just like walk around Austin, and people will pull me over and be like, wow, you play a lot of Rec Room, huh? And I'm like, I help build Rec Room. And they're like, oh my God, it's my favorite game. Like, I played so much. I met some of my best friends in Rec Room. And like, I've had that happen like a number of times. And it just feels, it's like the best feeling in the world to know that you helped in like a little way to build something that like made people that happy, or like, especially that introduced them to like important people in their life. That's like a major part of what I take away from Rec Room, is like, that was the best part for me, was knowing that we built something that introduced people to other people that they like became their best friends, or in some cases their partners, like got them a job or whatever it is. Like, that's the part that I solidified for the rest of my life, is like the type of thing I want to work on.
Yeah, definitely seeing a number of commentaries of people saying things like, oh, I played that so much when I was in high school or middle school, you know, like they're older now because it's been around for so long that you've had a few, you know, eras of people going through like their kind of middle school and high school. So, and I have my own memories of going through and playing it during the pandemic a lot. And some of the, you know, it was kind of low key enough, low barrier to entry, but still easy to pick up. Difficult to fully master, but still fun enough with the diversity of the different kind of guns and weapons to kind of have different types of play. I was always like, I always enjoyed the sniper, but also the laser shotgun was also great, and the other shotguns and machine guns were also some of my favorites. And so, or sometimes if I wanted to give it a little bit more of a, you know, I'd just use the regular pistol gun if I wanted to give a bit of a handicap to other people. but I just, a lot of fond memories of just kind of hopping in before this conversation to go into some of my favorite haunts.
And just
how it's going to be sad to see it go. I hope that there might be some ways of recreating some aspects of those popular worlds.
So there are projects happening where people are trying to like download all the rooms and then like host them on a new service. I've seen people posting about these. I don't want to name them in particular. If you search for them, you can find them, because some of them have had like security issues where people are like, I logged into this and I don't know how safe this is once I looked at the code or whatever. So like, you know, use your own discretion on these things, but people are trying to spin up kind of like preservation projects where you can still log in and like do some Rec Room stuff. And then there are projects where they're not explicitly trying to create like new servers or a login experience, but they are just trying to document like videos, photos, interviews with people. And I've had a number of those groups reach out to me who are doing their own kind of like rec room archiving projects. So if anyone is doing a rec room archiving project or knows someone who is or wants to participate in those, reach out to me and I can put you in touch with those people who are doing those, because you know I feel like they should all be kind of working together to some extent. So just, you can find me on whatever, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Sean Whiting. So yeah, definitely advise people to reach out to me if they have anything they want to do in the, like, you know, rec room preservation space.
Awesome. Well, Sean, thanks so much for coming on and sharing some of your thoughts and reflections on kind of an inside look of Rec Room. I was personally curious as to like what the story was. I think you helped fill in a lot of those gaps, but also just kind of reminisce and kind of reflect on lessons learned and some of these memories that you have and that I have, both yeah. of your time, kind of at the offices, but also in game. So yeah, I think it's something that is certainly going to have a huge impact on the kind of history of XR. So I'm glad that just to have a chance to be able to sit down with you to kind of reflect on the role of Rec Room on the broader XR industry. So thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Yeah, no problem. I was happy to do it. And, you know, I feel like I needed to close it out just because we've done 3 or 4 of these over the years. And, you know, if I'm taking a break from XR for a while, this will be a nice thing to look back on at a certain point as my own little personal archive of, you know, what I went through in the industry.
Do a little bit of venting and say things that were frustrating that you couldn't talk about at the time, but now you can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did get into some of that, I guess.
But more than that, I think just kind of the fond memories of what Rec Room has meant to connecting people is the thing that I'm yeah. taking away.
Yeah,
just
for sure.
How it's really been a place of refuge for a lot of people. And yeah, so been a huge part of the XR industry. So thanks again for joining me out here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Yep, no problem.
So that was Sean Whiting of Rec Room. He was the head of creators, head of user acquisition, head of community growth and support, as well as the community design. So I have a number of different takeaways about this interview. Was that, first of all, well, first it's just sad to see Rec Room go. I know that I enjoyed jumping in there and playing in different rooms over the years, and certainly a lot during the pandemic, and really showed me the different dynamics of social VR. Certainly there's a lot of other competitors in this space with Gorilla Tag, but also like Meta themselves with Horizon Worlds. And so, yeah, I can't help but think that the platform provider is also one of the major competitors to one of their third-party applications. And just sort of like this weird conflict of interest things that were going on that, you know, I don't think that full story has been told, but we just get a little bit of a glimmer. And yeah, I guess, you know, another thing is just like, it's sad to see one of these companies that, you know, for a long time they were seeing as one of those unicorns, the $1 billion valuation, and, you know, on all these different platforms, I can't help but think that there's a little bit of a fracturing of the community in a way that just made their development process so much more difficult to be able to go on all those different platforms. Yeah. And I think near the end, they were looking for things to be the thing that was going to be the revenue generating thing. And also just interesting to hear from Sean, some of the backlash from the community itself, creating this culture of not buying or supporting things from Rec Room. I think that stemmed from a little bit of this misperception where they were advertising that they had this $1 billion or $3.5 billion valuation, which is different than how much money you have in the bank. And so I think people saw that they had all this money and that, you know, why would you give even more money to Rec Room? And so, yeah, I think that was certainly an interesting dynamic to hear a bit from Sean. And also, you know, just reflecting on these closed proprietary platforms, when you invest user generated content from the beginning, it'd be nice to be able to export and take to other places, but these entities don't really prioritize that because they want to keep people in. And then if they come across and have to shut everything, then all that stuff basically goes away. Yeah, just kind of reflecting on what's it mean to have these user generated platforms in this day and age on these closed platforms. But also just, you know, I think speaking to that, we're kind of in this liminal transition stage and as we're moving to the next epoch of XR and the immersive industry. So yeah, and I guess I had some of my last moments in PvP within Rec Room. And yeah, it's just some really fun experiences that I've had on the platform. Definitely be sad to see it go on June 1st to be able to log on anymore. So that's all I have for today. And I just want to thank you for listening to the Voices of VR podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a listener-supported podcast. And so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue bringing this coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.